The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app.
לימים שבו הנה הקלה קרבה ועולה.
Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got an awesome show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we will be featuring world-renowned lecturer, authorer, professor, Rabbi David Bleich, who is from the Yeshiva University, has written a book, The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha, Jewish Law. This is an important book that's come out, a important tome, I would say. And we're going to be most honored to have Rabbi Bleich come on. We have a wonderful assortment of music for you, starting off everything as we always do. The portion of the week is the portion of Va'era, can be found in the book of Exodus, chapter 6 and following, a dynamic, wonderful Hasidic story. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. IDF officials express concern over recent anti-army activities by Arabs in Palestinian Authority-controlled areas of Judea and Samaria. Soldiers attempted to round up terrorists. In several recent incidents, Arabs rioted when the soldiers entered the town or villages to arrest the people. One Arab terrorist was killed by IDF soldiers when he opened fire in Qalqiya. Another Arab terrorist was killed in the town of Jenin. An IDF soldier was killed along the Lebanese border by sniper attack. The IDF jeep the soldier was riding in came under attack during routine patrol of Israel's northern border. In a rare move, the UN Security Council condemned the attack. Israel is giving the remains of 36 Palestinians buried in the Numbers graveyard to the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Israel said the decision is part of a pledge to gradually hand over the remains of all Palestinians buried in several Numbers graveyards, what they call Numbers graveyards. The graves are identified only by numbers. 91 remains have already been returned. Close to 1.7 million people in Israel live below the poverty level. That may sound really terrible, but, and that's being 23% of the population. Last year, 1.8 million people lived in poverty in Israel. So that means 100,000 people in Israel no longer live in poverty that did last year. Jacob Ostreicher, an Orthodox Jewish American businessman held captive in Bolivia since June of 2011, is back in the U.S. Ostreicher was arrested in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, while overseeing a rice-growing venture he had invested in. He was never formally charged. Details of his release have not been forthcoming. To date, six black youths ranging in ages between 11 and 20 have been arrested for knockout assaults. In what is described as a game, the black teenager punches a random Jewish person in the face. The six are being charged with a variety of offenses, but interestingly enough, none of them are being charged with a hate crime. And finally, the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee passed a bipartisan bill that aims to strengthen the ties between U.S. and Israel on energy. The bill hopes to create a partnership in developing natural gas and alternative fuels in the academic, business, and government levels. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Fidman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online Rabbi J. David Bleich from Yeshiva University, who has written a book, which is just recently published by Magid Press, a division of Koren Publishing, The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. How are you today, Rabbi Bleich?
Fine, and how are you?
Good. Baruch Hashem. Thank God we're doing quite well. So this, could you tell us a little bit about the background behind writing a book, The Philosophy of Philosophy?
The book is a collection of articles and essays that were written over a period of years. After enough of them were written, someone suggested that they be put between hardcovers and published as a book. The work isn't a philosophy of halacha. I wouldn't have the temerity to undertake something of the sort, nor am I convinced that would be a legitimate enterprise. What the book contains are a series of discussions of topics that are philosophical in nature, but that they have impact upon halacha or vice versa. They are matters of halacha, which have a philosophical component. Things like the principles of Jewish faith, the 13 principles of Rambam are discussed in a variety of different contexts, different issues, the attitude of Judaism toward natural law, whether natural law plays a role in halacha at all, whether there is a sharp dichotomy between ethics and halacha, or whether there is no ethic outside of halacha, and what we call ethics is really a branch of halacha, matters of that nature.
Okay, indeed. We're going to discuss a little bit more in detail some of these the topics mentioned in the book. Let's start with the first chapter, which is entitled Faith and Dogma in Judaism. When I was becoming religious, one of the salient points was impressed upon me is that in Judaism, there is very little dogma. We don't do things just because we do them, but there's always rhyme and rationale, and I was always told that for every question there's an answer, and for every answer there's a question. Could we talk about Jewish dogma, Rabbi Bleich?
Yes, we can, but we have to understand what the word means. The term dogma in philosophical jargon means that which is revealed. In a certain sense, all of halacha is dogmatic. It's proclaimed at Sinai. By the same token, when we talk about dogmas in this context, we're talking about matters of belief, faith. And it's widely stated out there that Judaism has no dogmas. It's a religion of law, religion of action, religion of conduct. And insofar as faith commitments are concerned, you're, to a large extent, pretty much on your own. That is absolutely incorrect, and that's what the chapter that you're referring to deals with. It shows that while there may have been some controversy with regard to fine points of matters of Jewish belief, but Jewish belief is fundamental to Judaism. It's integral to Judaism, and one cannot be a professing Jew without subscribing to a series of dogmatic principles. That has nothing to do with the issue of asking questions and the notion that every question has an answer, but part of this is that we don't necessarily know the answers to all questions.
Okay, let's deal with the basic, the belief in God, for example. The way I'm led to believe is that it's not a dogmatic belief in God, but it's a belief in God based on logic. Is that a correct assumption, Rabbi Bleich?
Yes and no. There are two ways to reach a belief in God. One is on the basis of philosophical speculation, and the Rambam and the Mir Nevuchim presented a number of philosophical proofs for the existence of a deity, which in turn formed the basis of Aquinas' five proofs for the existence of a deity. He relies very heavily in developing a number of those proofs upon what the Rambam wrote in the Moreh Nevuchim. Other Jewish philosophers have also written extensively in an attempt to demonstrate that belief in a deity is demanded by reason. But not everybody is a philosopher, and not everybody can formulate those principles and develop the argument. There is what we usually call emunah pshuta, plain, simple faith, which is based upon tradition, the Mesorah. You were told that there is a Rabbanu Shel Olam by your parents. They heard it from their parents, and so ultimately, if they had any questions, they perceived it at Mount Sinai. The perception of Mount Sinai was quite different from a philosophical group. It was a phenomenological experience. And Kuzri, for example, quite apart from that, talks about the notion of inherited tradition, which is basically the statement that there is belief based upon affirmation of a received tradition. There is a statement which I have had difficulty locating, but which I read many, many years ago. My problem is I'm not quite sure about the source. I think it was in the Sefer HaYosher of Rabbi Natan, that Avraham Avinu, Hikir Esbeira, different versions in the Midrashic statements with regard to what age. But I remember...
Let me jump in, Rabbi Blake. Could you explain that in English, please?
That Avraham Avinu recognized the existence of a creator early in life. And the Sefer HaYosher, a work written by Rabbi Natam, one of the Tosafists, makes the comment that after he had, in effect, developed the philosophical proof, he went to consult Shem, the son of Noach, who was literally the Rosh Yeshiva of the age, because he wanted to confirm it on the basis of the Mesorah, on the basis of a revealed tradition. Underlying that statement is a notion that if you are engaged in philosophical speculation, you may be right, you may be wrong. You have a proof, and somebody will come tomorrow and poke holes in the proof. But if you have eyewitness testimony, which is then passed on to subsequent generations, that is a matter which is no longer subject to challenge. And that Avraham wasn't satisfied with a mere philosophical proof. He wanted to be the recipient of the tradition. Now, the thrust of that statement was simply to underscore the fact that the Mesorah plays a tremendous role in the formulation of Jewish beliefs. The notion that these principles were extant throughout the period of Jewish history and that have been passed on from generation to generation.
Indeed. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Rabbi J. David Bleich, who's written a book, The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha, meaning Jewish law. And it is definitely a tome worth spending time with. Not an easy read. Definitely something which is mind-expanding and quite challenging, as I found. I've always found it sort of as a thing to pride ourselves, Rabbi Bleich, that Maimonides was able to cull through the extent of Jewish literature and boil down our belief system to only 13 things and to present them in such a rational order where they're sort of like built one upon the other. So could we spend a little time on Maimonides' 13 principles, Rabbi Bleich?
Yes, we can. The notion of principles is itself a difficult one. There are many Jewish beliefs that are not included in the principles. And the question is, why did he single out those in particular? And that's something that was dealt with by his successors, Crescas, Duran, Albo. The Rambam, Maimonides, is certainly not saying that that is all that a Jew has to believe. What he was doing was depending upon which of the commentators on his writings you follow. He was either giving you a kind of minimum faith requirement with regard to which you can't plead ignorance. This you must be aware of. You might not know other things, might never have thought about them, but this you must know about. Or he was listing a number of principles which were subject to dispute by people of his age, and these they were. They were principles that were disputed by either Islam or by Christianity in whole or in part. The Rambam, in his formulation, and many people are unaware of it, was more concerned with the details than with a bare statement of fact. Most people, I suspect, are aware of the 13 principles on the basis of what they read in the Siddur. Rambam never wrote what's in the Siddur. That was someone who tried to digest the 13 principles and presented them in a very, very compact way. When the Rambam's formulation is in his introduction to the final chapter of Sanhedrin in his commentary on the Mishnah, and there he talks in greater detail. For example, when he talks about Mashiach, the coming of the Messiah, redemption, he doesn't even bother saying that the coming of the Messiah is a fundamental principle. His point in one of the briefer formulations of a principle, the others are even more lengthy, he proceeds to say that the fundamental principle is that the Mashiach will be a direct lineal descendant of King David. That's part of the principle that the Rambam postulates. When he talks about creation, it's not simply that God created the universe, but it's what philosophers call the doctrine of constant conservation or continual creation that we have incorporated in the prayer book in the phrase Mechadesh b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh bereishis. God literally recreates the universe on a continual and continuous basis. The principles are a lot more nuanced and a lot more detailed and far, far more sophisticated than one might think from simply reading the short precis that appears in the Siddur. But, you know, all of that is part of the discussion.
Indeed. Rabbi Black, when I was a young man and my world outlook wasn't as developed as it is now, it's always constantly developing, thank you. So I was in Kollel in Lubavitch in 770, and that was the year that the Lubavitcher Rebbe asked that a book of footnotes of Mari Mekaymais be compiled, since the Rambam didn't write his magnum opus citing sources. Mm-hmm. So I, working on that work of footnotes, I was led to believe that everything that the Rambam wrote down was actually based on some Jewish source, including the first four chapters, which deal with faith in God, and also the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, which deal with, you take into astronomy and all of the other things, were all based somehow in Jewish thought. Comes along, and I'm starting to read other sources that would like to maintain that Maimonides was influenced in his outlook by works like Aristotle, for example. So could you explain, is there this effect of the non-Jewish philosophers on Judaism in our outlook, and then how Judaism may affect the outlook of non-Jewish philosophers?
I think that you have to, simply for purposes of understanding, recognize the difference between comments, rulings that are found in the Mishnah Torah, this magnum opus, a halachic work, and what appears in the Meir Nevuchim. Those are two separate works and designed for separate purposes. There is no question that everything that is in the Mishnah Torah was based upon Jewish sources And I'm not going to quibble about minor points of medical advice that may have crept into the Mishnah Torah. Those aren't tremendously significant. But everything that the Rambam records in the Mishnah Torah has a source. He wrote without sources because he wanted to make it easier for the reader, for the student. Part of what he was trying to accomplish was to eliminate the need to consult voluminous reference works. And beginning with the Kesef Mishnah, it has been a task to try to reconstruct the Rambam's sources and his thought processes. And the volume that was published by, I believe, the Merkaz L'Inyonei Chinuch, we usually refer to as Lubavitch, certainly was a monumental work in providing all kinds of citations that were otherwise or would otherwise have been unavailable and unknown to the reader. When you look at the, there's no non-Jewish influence in the Mishnah Torah. That's just simply...
That's a relief.
If you look at the Gemara Nevuchim, you read the introduction. It was addressed to a student. The student had been exposed to the philosophy, which at the time was the Aristotelian system, and the student was confused. And the Rambam recognized the source of the confusion, and basically what he is doing is and telling the student what there is in this non-Jewish philosophical system that is totally off bounds as far as Judaism is concerned, and what there is in that system which is acceptable. To put it into a kind of modern format, it's like a yeshiva student who wants to know, and what about science? Are there things in science that I simply cannot accept? Or are there things in science that, while I may not have a Jewish source for them, are contradicted by Jewish sources, and hence I have to treat them the way you treat any other scientific hypothesis? That's what the Rambam was doing in the Marin of Luchim. So the question is, was he influenced by Aristotelianism, is really a non-issue. He's responding to Aristotelianism. When you respond to somebody, it's not an issue of being influenced or not being influenced. It's an issue of, and what do you do with this system? How do you react to the system? To an objective observer, there are no questions. When the Rambam formulates his own philosophical views, he does incorporate material ideas that you will find in Aristotle and Plato and Neoplatonists. Did he have Jewish sources for those? I'm quite sure he did. Otherwise, I don't believe he would have incorporated them when he is telling you his own opinions. By the same token, he on occasion makes the statement that if he were philosophically convinced about some of the points made by the philosophers, he would have no trouble reconciling them with Jewish sources. Do you call that influence? I don't call that influence. I call that saying that he has decided on his own, based upon his own intellectual reflections, and he has arrived at certain positions, which he finds to be a development of what he found in Jewish sources, but makes the perfectly honest and candid statement that had he been convinced differently, he would have been able to interpret some of those sources in a manner that is consistent with conclusions that he does not accept. I don't call that influence either. I call that scholarly objectivity.
Terrific. I am glad that we have that cleared up now. We are speaking with Rabbi J. David Bleich. He has written a book called The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. Large part of the book, or a significant part of the book, deals with Judaism and natural law. You bring in also Tikkun Olam. Could you explain what do you mean by natural law, Rabbi Bleich?
Natural law is, for somebody who hasn't had a philosophical background, a kind of a strange term. It doesn't mean what it sounds as if it means. Natural law is not to be confused with the laws of nature. The laws of nature are for the physicists. Astronomers, people who deal with things like that. Natural law is the notion that there is a legal system that is not dogmatic in the sense that it's not revealed, but you can simply close your eyes, lean back, think a little bit, contemplate your navel, and you will come up with those, quote, legal, close quote, principles.
Things that make sense, Jason, generally.
Well, sense in a moral connotation. Thou shalt not kill is probably the best example of a natural law principle, at least insofar as the lay mind is concerned. One of the serious issues in recent decades is, can somebody plead obedience to law as a defense when he's being charged with homicide, crimes against humanity, genocide, etc.? That's what the Nuremberg trials were all about. The defendant's defense was based upon truth. The law of the Edict of the Führer had the force of law, and they claimed that they were obeying the law. That is probably the case. The prosecution maintains that that's no defense, because you knew that the law was immoral. We had it again in the Vietnam era with regard to Lieutenant Cayley, who said he was following orders. I have no doubt that he was. Is that a defense? That's what the court-martial was all about. It is not a politically correct to affirm a natural law philosophy today, but our legal system and the mores of our society does subscribe to principles of natural law. There is no gainsaying it. The American Declaration of Independence, which every school child knows, was written by Thomas Jefferson. We believe that all men were endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. When he's talking about an unalienable right and being endowed by the Creator, he's talking natural law. He was cribbing literally from John Locke. He was talking about basic rights which are rooted in natural law, and therefore, if George III is violating them, I have the moral right to rebel against him. Question, and what made that legal? What gives all of this the force of law? The answer is nature. You were created that way. That's what natural law is all about. Things that can be apprehended by a moral conscience. And you don't have to be taught. You should be able to discover it by yourself. Not only is it morally correct, but there is a moral imperative. The is leads to the ought. I ought to behave that way. And if I don't behave that way, I deserve punishment, and society is fully justified in punishing.
Let me interject for one second. Does the Bible agree with that?
I don't know whether the Bible agrees with it or not. I'm not quite sure how to respond to a question of that nature. Some people would say, Hashefet Chaloris Liyas and Mishpot, is it possible that the judge of the world does not himself act justly is a natural law principle. I don't have to go that far. I don't have to look at biblical sources because Jewish law is not based upon biblical sources. It's based upon the Perush Shebaltei. I shouldn't say it's not based upon scriptural verses. Of course it is. But scriptural verses, as they are understood and transmitted, interpreted by the Perush Shebaltei. Question is there anything in Judaism which has as its root something other than that which was revealed at Sinai? Is there an independent font of revelation? Is there something outside of what is written that is binding? And that's something which I discuss in detail. And I think that to a limited extent, there is the concept of svara, which means, I don't know how to translate it. Some people translate it as legal logic. I don't think that's a good translation. I consider svara as it occurs in the Talmudic writings, as meaning something which is a priori, something which I, common sense, I know it. Now, there is at least one source in the Gemara that talks about homicide as being based, not upon a biblical prohibition against homicide, as being based not solely upon a biblical verse, but as being based upon an a priori moral concept. The obligation to suffer martyrdom rather than to kill somebody else is not derived from a biblical verse. The other cardinal transgressions requiring martyrdom are, with regard to homicide, even at the threat of losing one's own life, is presented as an a priori concept in translation. Why do you think your blood is sweeter than somebody else's? Why do you think your life is more valuable than somebody else? Why do you think that you have the right to kill somebody in order to save yourself? Now, if I can't kill someone, even in face of force majeure, duress that's going to result in the loss of my own life, then certainly I can't take somebody else's life for no good reason. And that is presented as an a priori concept to the extent that one has to grapple with, then why is it made a subject of revelation at all if you can figure it out on the basis of reason alone? I think that that's one natural law proposition that's universally accepted. Are there others? Well, I try to deal with that in the chapter. I don't think that natural law is a major or primary source of Jewish law at all. But I cannot dismiss the notion out of hand that there are certain principles that can be derived on the basis of reason and have a validity quite independent of anything that was revealed to man.
Indeed. What do we have time for one more question? And that's, sure. You deal with a subject called Tikkun Olam, the Jews' obligations to the non-Jewish society. Could you just give a synopsis? What is the Jew's obligation, Rabbi Bleich, with to the rest of the world?
I think that there's a multifaceted obligation. Basically, there is. We're dealing with a halachic problem. That's why this is the interface of halacha and philosophy. Do I have an obligation to go out knocking on doors of non-Jews and telling them that they dare not eat Eifer Min HaChai, they can't engage in vivisection? There's no such halachic obligation. Do I have an obligation to tell Jews that they have to observe the dietary code? Yes. What are my obligations to non-Jews? First and foremost, there is the obligation to present an example. The Tikkun Olam that is obligatory upon Jews is to serve as examples. Secondly, and I think it's no less important than the first, I think that there is an absolute obligation to respond to non-Jews, no less so than to Jews, when asked directly with regard to what does Judaism have to say about X, Y, or Z insofar as non-Jews are concerned. What is the Jewish position with regard to X, Y, or Z? That is a question which non-Jews should be posing to Jews. Remember that they are bound by the Noahide Code, the seven commandments which were universal, given to the sons of Noah. Problem is that they are not the direct recipients of revelation. Jews are the bearers of a Mesorah, a tradition. Tradition for Jews and a tradition for non-Jews as well. And if this is how divine providence operates, then it means that I have no right to refuse to answer if I'm asked the question and I know the answer. I think I've demonstrated that with regard to Jews, that if a Jew asks a competent halachic authority a question with regard to Jewish law, he has an absolute obligation to respond. And he has no less an obligation to respond to a non-Jew who asks a question with regard to the Noahide Code and, by implication, how he, as a non-Jew, is obligated to comport himself and how non-Jewish society is to establish its mores and social customs. That's all part and parcel of Tikkun Olam.
Okay, indeed. That's going to wrap it up. I'm just really just starting to scratch the surface. We could go on for the whole show with this. Our guest today has been Rabbi J. David Bly from Yeshiva University. He's written a book called The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. It is from Maggid Press. I guess distributed by Koren Publishers. And we want to wish you continued success, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Hey, Schulfman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. Let's do some music. We don't have a whole lot of time. The song is called Ad Olam. This is Benny Friedman together with the Hevra and the Yeshiva Boys Choir. Assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mycosup.com.
That's MI for Michigan, KO for kosher, and SUP for supervisors, mycosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. We got time for one more song. This is Dudu Fischer singing Das ist Yiddish. This is Jewish.
Das ist unsere Sprache. Mit der Wein und mit der Lach. Und Porsche ist es so gering.
Jede Wort ist tut er sing. Goi, ba viele, also ist ich stamm. Jede Schott an an der Tamm. Liebes klingt zart und ond. Jede Wort ist dir bakan. Weil du Seis mein Sprach, mit der Weh und mit der Lach. Und Porsche ist dieses aus dem Kling, jeder Wort ist tot, dann singt man, das ist Jiddisch. Seis mein Sprach. Treft, du machst ein Jiddisch Lied, und die Wörter sehnen mit, mit Akrebe. Und mit Awe, wei, 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 oi, Fidi singt sich es a See. Das ist Jiddisch, seis mein Sprach, mit Awe, nur mit Allah. Und Porsche, diese Sase, kring, jeder Wort ist tot, das singt, was das ist Jiddisch, seis mein Sprach. Es legt sich auf der Zung, tut es alle Mola Zung, oi Chavein, oi Chala. Jiddisch, Jiddisch, Jiddisch ist die schönste Sprache. Ja, ba, 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 ba.
Bye 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 bye. Kobi ta se gam ya ba ba ba. Ya ba 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 bye bye bye. Ay, so ein Geschmack. Weil du siehst leidisch.
Siehst mein Sprach. Mit der Welt und mit der Lach. Und Porsche dieses aus dem Kring. Jede Wort ist tot, das ist, weil du siehst jüdisch. Siehst mein Sprach. Du siehst jüdisch. Siehst mein Sprach. Mit der Welt und mit der Lach. Und Porsche dieses aus dem Kring. Jede Wort ist tot, das ist, weil du siehst jüdisch.
ערב טוב לכם, טוב שבאתם.
נו ותאי חלמץ, אז גיצח שזיין.
התכנסנו כאן כדי לדבר על כמה דברים העומדים ברומו של עולם, גבירותיי ורבותיי.
יו.
עוד מעט יעמוד כאן עץ. כאן, כאן, ממש על הדרך יעמוד עץ. עוד מעט תבוא אמא יהודיה ותספר על חוויות שלה קצת ונתרגש ביחד. כן, כן. ככה זה ביידיש. לא מפסיק לרגע להיות מעניין. מה אתה אומר, דודו?
דו, סיז יידיש, סיז משפח. Mitavel, mitalah, und poshet dieses azoi kring, jede Wort ist tot, das singt, weil das ist jiddisch, das ist jiddisch, das ist jiddisch. Sie ist mein Sprach.
Oh, das ist jiddisch.
The Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800.
Hey, Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. The portion of the week is the portion of Va'era. We're in the midst, the thick of this really good Bible story, because the portion of Va'era contains 7 of the 10 plagues. This is like, it doesn't, if you want Bible story, it just doesn't get better than this. This is like tops. Anyway, take an insight and take a look at something. One of the more interesting of the 10 plagues is the plague of hail. Now, we are of the opinion that if something's going to happen, it has to happen with a reason. Especially when you're talking about miraculous occurrences, the rule is that God just doesn't make miracles happen. Everything has to happen with purpose. So you have the plague of hail. The plague of hail was a setup for the plague of locusts, which comes in next week's portion, because the plague of hail knocked down all of the hard-growing plants, like all the trees got knocked down, and then leaving room for the locusts to come in next week's portion and eat up all the grass and herbs and stuff like that. The hail, we're not just... This isn't Kansas anymore, Dorothy Hale. The hail were, I would say, about the size, somewhere between golf ball and softball. And inside every hailstone was a fire, a flame. So that what would happen is as the hail hit the ground, it would crack open and it would start a fire. So the Egyptians had to deal with not only not getting crushed by this awesome hail that's going on, but not getting burnt by the ensuing fires. Now, generally, I don't think scientists have done this one yet. I think it's really difficult to stick a flame inside of an ice cube, but that would be so awesome. You order a drink, and the bartender hands you your drink, and you have these flickering ice cubes. That would be way awesome until you bit into one or until it melted in your drink and set your alcoholic beverage on fire. Anyway, I am beside myself. I'm having more fun than I should. So they haven't come up with such a thing yet. I don't think anybody's ever even thought about such a thing because it is so totally and absolutely against the laws of nature, because fire and ice do not mix. Fire is an expression of severe judgment. Ice, especially ice, is cold water, and ice is an expression of extreme kindness. What would the world be like if there was no water? No, there would be no life on it. In fact, they send all these probes to Mars, and what are they looking for? They're looking for ice. It's like you're spending billions of dollars to go find an ice cube. You just go to the freezer. But anyway, the two together form an amalgam. If you have two extremes and you put them together, what happens? I am reminded of Mr. Stanley's 8th grade science class. Now, what did Mr. Stanley was teaching us? He was teaching us about pH. And he had his little pH paper over there, and he had some hydrochloric acid. And he showed that the pH of hydrochloric acid is 1. And then he had some sodium chloride, which is known as lye. And he had his little pH paper, and he showed that the pH was 14. And he said, don't ever touch either one of these chemicals. They are extremely caustic. They will cause tremendous things to happen to your body. And so what did he do is he took an ounce of hydrochloric acid and an ounce of lye, and he mixed the two together. He showed that now the pH was 7, and then Mr. Stanley drank them. And nothing happened other than the fact that he said, boy, does that taste salty. Because when you mix hydrochloric acid and lye together, you get salt water. And we were, of course, as eighth graders, were really impressed with this. Because when you mix extremes, you have extremes going one end to the other, and you put the two together, what you wind up with is a perfect amalgam of moderation. So here it is, the Almighty is showing extremes. And really what is being expressed is the ultimate expression of compassion. It's still a plague, but it's not a plague, which is a punitive expression of godliness. It's an expression of compassion. Because by this point, everybody in the entire country is saying, you know, we had enough with these Jews. Can't you let them out? And Pharaoh, the only person in Egypt, the only person's opinion really counted, is the only person in the entire country that was saying, no, I'm not letting them out. Where is the compassion here? It says we have to, you know, sometimes compassion means to tell a person no. Person, an alcoholic, comes to you and says, I need a drink. I really need a drink. You give him a drink, is that a good thing? That's what he wants. You tell the person, no, you can't have a drink because I'm having compassion for you. The world, for all intents and purposes, was looking what was going on. This wasn't isolated. This wasn't happening like in a box, these plagues. The whole world knew about what was going on in Egypt, this natural phenomena. And they knew about Moses, and they knew about the plagues. And we say this was even expressed because it says that the inhabitants of Canaan were melting. The Edomites were quaking. They knew that all this was happening for the Jewish people. So the compassion which was being conveyed was a compassion towards these despotic rulers and an effort to get them to give up the Jewish people. It doesn't come until later, almost the end of next week's portion of Parshas Bo. What do we do with this information? I tell people I'm an extreme moderate. I am a rebel independent when it comes to politics, yes. Don't classify me as either, because moderation is really, it's called the middle path in Judaism. Maimonides speaks about it and says, there's no point in getting angry, nor is there any point in getting rolled over and steamrolled, as the point may be. What we need is to develop a happy medium. We have to find that happy medium, and we have to find time for our next break. Don't go away. We've got an awesome Hasidic story. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Spex Howard from the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts. We're happy to sponsor The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding for The Jewish Hour comes from its sponsors, it's listeners like you that help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. That's 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. Your help is greatly appreciated.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? RabbiFinman.com. You'll find archived editions of the show. You'll find the E-Parsha, the U-Parsha, the Hasidic U-Story, various media of yours truly conveying information in hopefully a fun and entertaining way. You'll also find the very important donations page. We're at the end of the year. It's the end of the month. bills still need to get paid. We haven't paid for December yet. We need, stuff has been coming in, thank God. Money comes in. We appreciate everything that's come in till now, but we have to pay the piper. The Jewish Hour is going into its 18 years on the radio, and it's only because you've been able to do it for us. And so every month I say, God, okay, you're on. Show me where it's coming from. Show me the beef. And every month the Almighty provides another angel, a messenger, who sends in a $10, a $5, a $20, a $100, whatever it is, the number you're comfortable with, send it in. Go to RabbiFinman.com, click on the donations page. Don't like doing it that way? Send in your donation of any amount to The Jewish Hour, 14,000 West 9 Mile Road, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. We got time for a real quick Hasidic story. There was a group of yeshiva students who would travel to Manhattan from Brooklyn every Friday. And they were basically, they would go through an entire skyscraper from going from office to office, searching for Jews and giving Jews the opportunity to the Jewish commandments, including the mitzvah of putting on tefillin, which is a morning prayer type thing. There was one office where the boss just wouldn't let them in the front door. This went on for months. Finally, what happened is they were, this group was just missed, they came Friday afternoon, and they just missed the subway. Ugh. There's a vendor standing in a subway system, not Jewish, and he goes over to this one guy and says, you need a tie. He's got all kinds of things. He's got watches, gloves, all this stuff. He says, you need a tie. Guy's arguing, I don't need a tie. He says, you need a tie. They argue. Finally, the guy, just to get him off his back, says, okay, everybody. The guy says, I need a tie. Give me a buck. He buys the tie. So he takes the tie, puts it in. He says, no, you got to put it on. He says, I don't even know how to tie the thing. He says, okay, I'll tie it for you. He ties it for him. He says, you have to wear it the whole day. He says, what are you, my mother? He says, okay, I will wear it the whole day. They walk into this one person's office again who wouldn't let him in the front door. Takes a look at them and says, who are you guys? He said, well, we're from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We're from Brooklyn, and we want to do mitzvahs like putting on tefillin. So he told him, come with me. He got nervous. Maybe they're going to have him arrested or something. He said, last night I had a dream, and I complained to the Lubavitcher Rebbe that I have problems. And the Rebbe said to me, but I send you students every week. And he said, but they're bums. They don't even wear ties. So one of them said, Lubavitcher Rebbe says, you want one to wear a tie? Okay, tomorrow one will wear a tie. And he woke up, had the dream. And they live, of course, they live happily ever after. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope you have a great week. And we hope to see you again next week. Take care.